You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And here we are with another Blunt Business on CannabisRadio.com. Joining me right now with offices in New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, California, Colorado, Florida, Michigan, and Texas. My next guest represents a full-service cannabis law firm with a coast-to-coast and global footprint. Very familiar to Cannabis Radio. You might have heard the team over on, even going as far back as our original programming back in 2015. We've been familiar with Vicente Cederberg, LLP. I'm joined by one of the partners, Charles Alavicetti. Charles, thanks for being on with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. So now Vicente Cederberg supports the tri-state area, which is a little bit of a focus we want to take on the start of the show with all of the rollout of legalization and implementation of said legalization, adult use and medical in New York and New Jersey proper. Now, you're offering a full suite of services, legal, corporate, regulatory policy research, all types of plant-touching marijuana, hemp businesses, ancillary businesses, investors, trade associations, and governmental bodies. Now, talk to me about some of the legal framework that your team has dealt with so far since the rollout of adult use in New York and New Jersey so far.
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to just focus on New York just to make it easier to answer the question, because it's a different answer in New Jersey and a different answer in Connecticut. So each of these states has kind of a unique system. And you know, frankly, I've been focused on New York just because of my own sort of time limitations, in picking up these states as they come up to speed, because Jersey has a pretty complicated system.
And that feels from the beginning, from the limited of dispensaries and licenses that they had to the fact that, you know, if people from New York wanted to go ahead and cross over to grab a product, it was a very difficult and has been that way for a while.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was going to say some systems are relatively simple from a regulatory standpoint, and some systems are pretty complicated, and New York, New Jersey are definitely on the complicated side of the spectrum. So yeah, I would defer, you know, my Jen Cabrera, my colleague, is our Jersey expert. She also does a lot in New York, but I defer to her on New Jersey, and then Michelle Bodian on the Connecticut side. So I'm just going to focus on New York, just because we only
That's totally fine. So, New York being the hot button right now, anyway, the most current rollout. Go for it.
So yeah, so just big picture, New York, it's interesting. You know, it's had a medical system for a significant period of time. Mm-hmm. There are currently 10 medical licensees in New York called ROs, or registered organizations. And the medical licensees are all vertically integrated and have multiple dispensary locations. So the current system in New York, purely medical, initially it was pretty limited in terms of the qualifying conditions. And if you look at sort of the robustness of a medical program, it's typically driven by two primary factors. One is, you know, what are the qualifying conditions? Because if you have limited qualifying conditions, it's tough to have a large patient base. And the second is just sort of access. You know, if you have a small number of dispensaries, it's tough to have a robust market. So New York initially was a pretty weak market in terms of the number of qualifying conditions, but it's grown substantially since then. And you've seen some pretty high profile deals where people are buying these medical licenses. And the reason they're so valuable is in the law, the MRTA, which is the statute that created the adult use system. The medical licensees are going to have an option after paying a fee, which is not specified in the statute. to get effectively a vertically integrated adult use license to pair with their medical license, and it'll allow them to open multiple adult use dispensaries. So they will be, with a very minor exception we might get into later on the cooperatives,
sure,
the only people that will be allowed to be vertically integrated on the adult use side, which is important for a couple of reasons. You know, one is you just got to understand with taxes, if you don't have a cultivation as part of your operations, it really hurts you on the taxes, because it's much easier to deduct costs associated with a cultivation facility than a dispensary. And the second is just margin, because you can, you know, you can sell your own products. So you're not buying, you know, flour and concentrate, what have you, wholesale. So it, it presents a significant advantage. And that's why I think you saw these licenses trade for such a large dollar amount, notwithstanding the recently broken Ascend MedMen deal.
I want to talk more about licensing. We're going to do that at the break. But in the terms of the costs for setup and startup, for some of these companies looking to make their way in the space, once they get the licensing, well, we've heard a lot of stories so far about the pricing being a lot, especially for social equity based businesses that want to be a part of the space, and the kind of relief that is being done out there from government relief through the state legislature or through various private entities trying to help out with funding and trying to help smooth out the process to get there. What can you tell me so far, you know, based from other markets, about where that would be the cause for concern about the upstart cost and what kind of legal untangling you have to go through to get started?
Well, the thing in New York that's really unique, right? You've seen these social equity programs arise in a bunch of states. And really one of the main problems with these social equity systems is that, you know, you define social equity in a way that sort of means that most of these people are not going to have much capital, or the networks that you would need to raise capital. And then, you know, then they want a license, they don't have the money to operate the business. So they may have to cut kind of a, you know, what some people might say is a predatory deal with a third party. So what's New York, what's unique about New York is they have a special license called the CARD license, Conditional Adult Use Retail Dispensary.
Okay.
And this is, it's unique because for a few reasons, one of which is that to apply for it, it has to be majority owned by someone who has a cannabis conviction in the state of New York, which is sort of 180 degrees of when we started doing this thing in 2015, and they would disqualify you for these convictions. You know, the idea here is to sort of try and restore the damage from the drug war. But the other really unique thing is the state has said that it's going to finance these businesses. They're going to give them loans at a low interest rate, and they're also going to help them get real estate. So the state of New York, DASNY, the Dormitory Authority, the state of New York, has gone out, has hired a broker, and they're trying to lock down dispensary locations, which they'll then sort of help these licensees sign up for. And then they're going to lend them the money at this sort of low interest, you know, kind of generous terms. So the idea here is that, in theory, at least, you wouldn't need any outside financing to run one of these businesses. Now, you know, with the people I'm working with, I always caution them, you know, obviously it'd be great if the state comes up with all the money, but they may not show up with the money you need to run the business. So, you know, you may have to pivot and try and raise outside financing. But, you know, that's one of the challenges. Of course, you know, when you're talking about startup costs for business,
right?
It does really vary based on the license type.
Well, let me just run through a story about the fact that there's a bunch of stories that actually your firm has written on, published about, of one of the parts is cannabis business funding and equity considerations. For those looking specifically to enter New York, a couple of paragraphs I want to read from here real quick. First, once you have your entity and tax status selected, you may need to focus on getting the necessary capital to get your business licensed and operational. Generally, entrepreneurs have the option of raising funds by issuing debt or equity. If you plan to raise funds through debt, lenders are less likely to care what type of entity they are lending to. Historically, equity investors in the startup and venture capital space have been typically more comfortable with dealing with corporations. However, in our experience, we've seen investors become more comfortable investing LLCs, leading to more and more entrepreneurs electing the LLC structure. Entrepreneurs should also remain mindful of any requirements pertaining to social equity status or future requirements that New York might place on certain license types. While these license types can provide some advantages when it comes to the licensing process, they may present challenges for raising capital by restricting the amount of equity that can be issued to investors. Mm-hmm. This can be particularly challenging for applicants with limited assets and no revenue on which to base their valuations. I wanted to bring that point across and let you expand on that.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess a couple issues. One is just entity choice. And, you know, most companies in the US that are, call them startups, as opposed to, you know, like a family business, you know, are formed as either corporations or LLCs. And really either structure can work. There's, you know, some people have strong opinions one way or the other. The primary difference really is how they're taxed. You know, a corporation has two levels of tax, and LLC is taxed like a partnership typically, and will only have one level of tax. The nuance for a social equity company is the state has specific requirements for what its cap table needs to look like to maintain in good standing. So in New York, with these retail, these conditional retail licenses, you know, essentially it has to be majority owned by someone who has both a cannabis conviction or someone in their immediate family. And they have to have been an owner of a profitable business. So, you know, 51% of your cap table is effectively sort of locked in. So you've only got 49% to play with if you have to raise money. And that's the challenge here is, right. You know, suppose the remainder of the 49% of the company, if the 51% has to stay 51%, the other shareholders effectively get sort of double diluted by any financing that comes in. And the other thing to bear in mind is that any changes in that cap table are going to require regulatory consent. So you can't necessarily do it quickly.
No, it's going to be a long process and a probably expensive process at that. And so, Charles, I want to go to break. You had mentioned before about co-op licenses or cooperative licenses. I want to ask you about that, and also the areas where it comes to businesses opening up LLCs. I want to ask you about that as well. And a number of things when it comes to, I'll just leave it right there. I'm here with Charles Alavesetti, partner at Vicente Cederberg LLP here on Blunt Business. We'll be back after a short break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear. My sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. I didn't want to give out all the little T's and details. I wanted to make sure everybody stuck around for the break. Vicente Cederberg, partner Charles Alversati, is with me on Blunt Business. And Charles, I wanted to continue a little bit on the area of what was discussed before about cannabis business funding and equity considerations for the New York market we're specifically talking about in the program today. The explanation on the licensing process from the same story, there are a variety of entity types to choose from, but most are either a corporation or a limited liability company, LLC, LLC being the newest business type entity and providing the most flexibility. Whether the LLC will be operated more similarly to a corporation or a partnership is a decision for each respective LLC's founders. One consideration that's unique to New York, which you mentioned before the break, was cooperative or co-op licenses. Entrepreneurs interested in applying for one of these co-op licenses should speak with counsel at their earliest convenience, as New York has specific requirements for entity selection and corporate governance. Can you break down what the co-op licenses entail in terms of those requirements?
So a co-op license is, you've seen other states do something like this. California has a license type like this. It's meant to be sort of a small social equity license type that allows you to be vertically integrated. And this is what I was talking about earlier when I mentioned there's kind of one small exception for vertical integration. And that's for these co-op licenses. Now, you can't actually apply for these yet. There's only three license types right now in New York on the adult use side that they've actually given out or are in the process of giving out. That's cultivation, processing, and retail. Retail is going on right now. It closes on September 26th. So if you got a marijuana conviction in the state of New York and you own a profitable business, you got 6 days to apply. But yeah, the co-op license is going to come out later. We don't really have the regulations yet, but it's essentially meant to be sort of a smaller license that will permit you to be vertically integrated. I don't know how, off the top of my head, I don't know how large the, you know, the canopy can be. I imagine it's probably not huge because it's typically a smaller type operation these are licensed for. And then you can form that as a cooperative, which is sort of an entity type that you almost, I've never seen in I guess over 7 years of cannabis work, I've never seen an entity that's been formed as a cooperative. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I think it basically, it is what it sounds like, which is that it's sort of like primarily agricultural cooperative. It's not necessarily as bottom line focused as a typical entity type. And there may be ways for people to contribute capital to a cooperative without being offsides of the license cap and vertical integration prohibition in New York, which are both pretty strict. So in New York, they've got basically it's like alcohol. It's a modified two-tier system where you either have to be on sort of the grow processing side, or you can be on the kind of retail consumption lounge side, but you can't be on both sides. And when I say you can't be on both sides, I mean, you really can't be on both sides. There are limitations on being even a small equity holder in a grow and a small equity holder in a store. It's pretty strict. And then you're also limited in terms of how many licenses you can hold on each side of the fence. But a cooperative, there seems to be a way within a cooperative to contribute capital to a co-op without kind of implicating yourself in this vertical integration prohibition. So I think that's interesting. And I hope it makes it easier for the social equity licensees to raise capital, because that's kind of the challenge, you know, I face in advising our clients, that oftentimes they have challenges raising money. And then, you know, I look at it as like raising money is tough, right? On its own. I don't know if you've ever tried to raise money for a company, but convincing someone, convincing someone to give you, you know, their cash to build a business is not always easy. Right. And then on top of that, you know, you start to stack additional challenges, right? Which is, you know, not only do I need to find someone who's willing to invest in cannabis, they also can't have any of certain types of investments in the state of New York, or they never want to make these investments in the future because by investing in you, they precluded making those investments. So that's kind of my big message to any regulators who are listening is I understand the concern to protect people and to avoid sort of exploitative deals, but you know, people also need to be able to raise money, because if you can't raise the money for your cooperative, and hopefully it's easier, unless you have a substantial amount of money in the bank, it's going to be tough to get that business off the ground.
Part of the thing too, that I've always talked about here on the program and just, you know, internally, is the fact that there were a lot of companies that we saw that were given quite a bit of seed funding. They went through seed rounds, got funding, and then the money was squandered. Without naming names, it's just something where there was some real irresponsible, frivolous use of funding for, you know, nefarious purposes. And I remember just working, you know, and connecting with people 10 years ago for a startup community, a networking community of different people that were trying to start up their businesses, reaching out to people that were either angel investors or whatever, trying to go ahead and, you know, speak what they have of what they're offering in terms of trying to get funding and trying to get their product up to market and trying to get the licensing in terms of like a cannabis business, same way would be here. But that's, I'm pretty sure. Now, is that, do you feel like, is that something that is still a major cause of concern, or do you feel like as we're getting that more of that, more or less that kind of activity is being weeded out?
No, I mean, it's, you know, here's, if people have invested their money in the space and they didn't do well on their initial investment, I think it, you know, not surprisingly, it makes them a little hesitant to invest again.
Yeah.
Or if they have already invested sort of all their money that they feel comfortable investing in cannabis, that also makes it tougher to raise money. So yeah, the challenge is that, you know, people are a little gun shy now, I think,
right,
about the sector. I mean, I remain very bullish about the sector long-term, but I totally understand why people might be skeptical. There have been bad actors in the industry. I mean, I would say there's the people that have lost money for their investors that they weren't bad actors. I mean, you know, starting a business is tough, and a lot of people went out, raised money, gave it a honest try, and just weren't able to deliver. I mean, it's not, you know, it's like you don't hit a home run every time you come up to bat, right?
No, but I also think there are just some of those people that invest that they want to go into something that's kind of an alternative or fringe, not your traditional investment. So they still see cannabis as that. And so there are some people that will, you know, take their money from another space, and they don't mind the high risk. They might think it's just high risk. Let's just go for it. They might not realize that, you know, the people that have come into the industry, that if you want to do a kind of prospectus and really understand and evaluate where the industry's gone in the last five, like especially in the last 7 years you've been practicing in cannabis, you see the difference. You see the players that are in here. And the other thing I have always been a point of, I always reference this interview with Steve D'Angelo on the Green Peak on our companion series with Richard Zwicky, always making the point that there are, among people he knows of in Silicon Valley, there are definitely those investors that are just waiting for the lever to be pulled on legalization nationwide. And then you're going to have another influx of capital available for investment to various companies out there. But in the meantime, MSOs are just combining and consolidating forces until we get to somewhere. And I'm sure that's the same thing going on in New York.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, you know, if you look at, if you sort of do the, you know, kind of the Venn diagram, right? One circle is people with capital that they're able to, you know, that they have ready to invest. And then the other circle is people that are willing to invest in cannabis, right? So it's not, you're only capturing a certain percentage of the capital pool available in the United States. You know, obviously institutional money is largely outside of the space. You know, some institutional money has gone into other countries, right? You know, Canada being a big example, though people necessarily haven't done great on that investment, I think has dampened expectations.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think that, you know, that's why if you look at a lot of what people are saying, you know, that's why people are so excited about SAFE Banking potentially passing, because, you know, that just sends a signal to the market that this thing's on the upswing. And, you know, if and when, you know, when that passes, that's definitely going to, I think, lead to a uptick in stock prices and in capital coming into the industry.
So the lame duck session came and went. Congress could have done something, but, you know, more than likely than not, the midterm elections are here. So any other potential passage, we just have to see how things shuffle in Congress for November 2022, the midterm elections coming up. Until then, we can't see any kind of relief like that. We're just going to have to wait another 3 to 6 months to see if anything else rears its head, to see if anything will happen. So that's what it is in that whole part. I want to go ahead and go to another break. And there's some great work that you're doing in terms of pro bono work that I definitely want to spotlight on. That's extremely important. And I'm really happy to go and read about this. And I also want to talk about thoughts about the potential opportunities in psychedelics. As you know, Cannabis Radio, we've already launched several series on the network that are specific on that. We have our Psychedelic Passes series, Psychedelic Radio. And we do quite a bit of psychedelic talk with our new series with Dr. Lola Ohomba with Let's Talk Plant Medicine. Make sure, if you haven't gone to Cannabis Radio lately, we have 6 new series now available, actually 5, one more in the works as I'm recording this today, that are now available with new episodes. Go ahead and look. We got a lot of new content up on the website. Check that out in the meantime. And we're going to come back with more with Charles Olivicetti, partner at Vicente Cederberg LLP, here on Blunt Business after a short break.
Rolling into some sponsors, but we'll be right back with more Blunt Business.
Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with a partner at Vicente Cederberg. By the way, website is vicentecederberg.com, V-I-C-E-N-T-E-S-E-D-E-R-B-E-R-G. And Charles, I want to go into a couple of the stories to wrap things up here. One of your firm's attorneys, Shane Pennington, spoke with Gondra Madure, and he talked about the work done pro bono in a lawsuit against the Drug Enforcement Association or Administration, the DEA, by Dr. Sue Sisley, MD, who we praise and, you know, we cheerlead for her with her great work that she's been doing to deal with the DEA and the same thing with the FDA for that in general as well. For years, she's been trying to get federal approval for her study that sought to investigate the therapeutic effects of cannabis for veterans with PTSD. That's been her the path that she's been trying to take, this effort she's been trying to make. So far, 7 bulk manufacturer marijuana growers have received a federal cultivation license from the DEA and the United States Department of Justice. Therefore, these 7 licensees now can produce and sell cannabis for research purposes. This is a huge step for science and the future of cannabis. What can you tell me about the progress being made here and what's been done here? Really, the importance that you see now as a firm to help Dr. Sue Sisley out.
Yeah, well, I mean, so, you know, at that root, the problem is pretty simple, which is that if you were trying to do research on cannabis, historically, you could only get cannabis from the one licensed grow from the feds, which was at Ole Miss. And that's been operational for a long time. And the problem is that their cannabis is not very good and they can't really grow it to spec. Because for these studies, if you read what Dr. Sisley has been trying to do, you know, they want certain types of strains, they want certain amounts of THC, certain amounts of CBD, right? And you can't really dial that in at the old facility. And people would always complain about what they would get from them. So that's why, you know, you have to have a better grow facility if you're actually going to do real research. So as you point out, 7 people have these federal licenses. There have been, I think Shane was telling me, like something like 70 applications in front of the agency. They 5 were accepted in 21, 2 more since then. There's not really a reason to think they might issue additional ones. But there's 7 out there, which is, you know, it's a lot better than 1. This Scottsdale Research Institute, which is the one that Dr. Sisley is working with, is, you know, it's actively growing. So
I think wonderful to see that go on and to hear that kind of news, because I know that across the board, I've been talking on this show about the need for the ability to do research, to be able to go ahead and have the, you know, have the product grown so you can actually have something to test. Because it was always so much about having to go ahead and find ways to outsource or what was available to test and do research for, which was always a major issue. But now having these licenses out here for the purpose of, and that the DEA and DOJ have finally let that happen. And, you know, it's the fact that that's a commendable that Vicente Cederberg was able to do that and go up against the government to get this to happen.
Yeah, no, it was pretty exciting to see it happen. I mean, obviously, you know, there's so much potential, I think, from a medical perspective about the plant. And it would be unfortunate if most of the research is done overseas. I mean, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's just a question of where, you know, in the globe it occurs.
Well, because we've heard a lot about what's happening in Israel and the great work they're doing. But of course, every time it gets brought over here, I mean, just imagine with the FDA implementation of the hemp bill and how that's not gotten passed yet. We don't have the requirements, the regulations, any kind of framework yet. And this is what, 4 years later, because of the fact that there's all these different pieces of red tape that, okay, here's the research from Israel. What well, doesn't matter? We don't have it here. Well, now we're trying to get it here. We've been trying to do that for years. Mm-hmm. And it's just trying to further the cause. That's part. It's just, I mean, I should be surprised anymore. Sometimes I used to feel like I was a little bit triggered or bothered by it, but really I just feel so cynical now. It's just like, it's part of life. But like I said, it's firms like yours that are making that effort. That's very important. So I really appreciate that. Wanted to make sure I point that out as we go along. One of the story I want to wrap up with you, Charles, is How about your firm has recently written about current commercial opportunities that involve psychedelics? Let me read this real quick. Quote, two approaches apply to commercial operations, the traditional medical path and the emerging non-medical state regulative path. While the other two paths are better seen as non-commercial, which is underground therapy and religious use. So we're saying ceremonies or journeys. Can you expand on those opportunities and what the FDA has approved so far that warrants a potential opportunity? As we talked about, we don't have to worry about any kind of government legislation. It's what the FDA decides to approve, which particular treatments or which particular medications are deemed, you know, safe and allowed to be administered.
Well, I would point out that, you know, legislation would help things. Mostly because most of these psychedelic substances are Schedule One, which means that according to the Controlled Substances Act, there's no accepted medical use for them, and they're considered at high risk of abuse. So any down scheduling, and it doesn't necessarily mean you can get a prescription for it right off the bat, but if you were to reschedule it, it's going to make it easier to do research, to go through FDA trials and all that. But I don't think there's any legislation coming anytime soon. That said, there are a lot of pretty exciting trials that are going on right now. A lot of these companies are publicly traded, and this is what I call the traditionally regulated medical practice path. And these are basically companies that are, you know, they've got a drug somewhere in the, you know, the approval process with the FDA. So, you know, if you look this up, right, like an example for psilocybin would be the Compass Pathways study. And then, you know, there are also studies in later phases with respect to MDMA. The only psychedelic right now that can currently be prescribed is ketamine. So that sort of explains the ketamine clinics. You can see everything else is not, you can't get a prescription for right now.
Right.
For any reason. So yeah, there's like basically two potential pathways we could see move forward for psychedelics on a commercial level, right? You know, I point out in the article, if you Google my name and psychedelics, you can find it pretty easily. But if you look at Michael Pollan's book, you know, everything he's describing in that book is sort of these sort of like below the radar, sort of underground therapists or you know, sometimes people call them shamans, right?
Right.
That stuff is all sort of non-commercial. Like those people aren't going out and raising money from venture funds. But there's going to be a new path forward, which is similar to cannabis, right? Which is it's regulated, pretty heavily regulated at the state level, but it's outside of the traditional medical system. So Oregon's going to be the first one that launches. They've got their draft rules out. Which, you know, if you look at what I've written, my colleague Sally did a summary of these rules, but they're going to start licensing in 2023. It's going to be a lot like cannabis, right? So it's not, you know, the psilocybin, what have you, it's not going to be prescribed by doctors. It's not sort of done under the purview of the FDA. It's done under a state regulated system. And and we've also got a ballot initiative that's going to create something similar in Colorado that hopefully passes this fall, knock wood. It's my partner, Josh Kappel, who's been spending a lot of time on that. And then, you know, hopefully you see other states kind of follow in the footsteps.
Right.
You know, that I don't know what, yeah, exactly. So,
well, yeah, I want to go and bring a few things that you brought up and make sure to give context so that the audience can go ahead and find all this information out there. Number one, when you mentioned Compass Pathways, a London-based company, and a nonprofit Usona Institute in Madison, Wisconsin, being granted FDA breakthrough therapy status for psilocybin treatments and launch phase two trials. And so they are recruiting, what, over 200 people, random clinical trials, and going through so much with that, not to mention the other research being done out there when it comes to the, in London, with what I think was a United College. Also, not to mention all the work that's being done in State University of Stanford or Johns Hopkins University and all the work they're doing on psychedelics as well. And also the link to the story you're talking about, look for it on VicenteSederberg.com in their blog under Insights. Look for understanding the current legal status of psychedelics in the United States. and you give a great breakdown of all the active clinical trials and state regulated systems. So you understand which particular medications or which particular treatments are, where they are with legal status, where they are in active FDA regulated clinical trials and state regulated systems. It's all broken down there for you. Plus, you also talk about proposed legalization and about initiatives that could impact legal status of psychedelics. Bookmark this link if you would. You should go and do that. I will try to make sure to go ahead and get this included into the show description to have people to go ahead and check that out as well. Charles, so much information. We're out of time. If I had more time, I would go and continue, but I think we're just going to go and table. Let's come back to this, especially on the psychedelics part. I'd love to go and continue that conversation.
Yeah, no, likewise. I mean, psychedelics is super exciting.
It's amazing. I mean, yeah. We've really been opening our eyes in the last year and a half to seeing what's going on now. And just, you know, it's like right now, psychedelics is starting to hit viral. The momentum is really coming up right now. And, you know, in a way, I still think, yeah, it's going to have that same kind of trajectory where cannabis was 5 years ago. But I think there are some things that are, there's some things that are happening, which will be more in the favor of psychedelics that will give us a little bit less issues towards progress like cannabis had to go through, because cannabis had a much bumpier ride, but I don't think psychedelics should have that much. I think the fast track to various legalization, whether it's in Colorado or Washington State, or what they've already done in Oregon so far implemented, we're going to just see where it goes. So I appreciate you taking time out to talk to us again. I've been joined with Charles Alavicetti, partner at Vincente Cederberg LLP. Thanks for taking out time to go ahead and tell us all about the great news you're doing right now in New York and New Jersey and the various parts when it comes to pro bono work and psychedelics. Thanks again.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And real quickly, for people that want to go and either connect with you or the firm, please let people know how they can go and contact you.
Yeah. I mean, really, if you just Google Alavicetti, I have a pretty unique last name. If you just Google Alavicetti, you'll find me pretty easily.
Yeah.
Just go to the website, VicenteCederberg.com. But really, just Google Alavicetti Cannabis or just Alavicetti, and you can find me and you got my email address. And of course, I'd also suggest if you're interested in cannabis, I wrote the book on cannabis law. It's called The Cannabis Business. It's kind of a breakdown of, it's like Cannabis Law 101. If you're interested in the space, I suggest you read up on the laws. All profits go to charity. You can buy it wherever you can buy a book, you know, Amazon, BarnesandNobles.com, all that kind of stuff.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again. We'll definitely keep in touch. And thank you, listeners, for listening to another Blunt Business. We'll talk to you next time. The opinions expressed on this CannabisRadio.com program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of CannabisRadio.com. Any rebroadcast, republication, or retransmission of this program without proper consent is prohibited.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.